Blog Talk Radio.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornel West. Yes. Peace to the movement. Yes. We came from the bottom. Ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind, and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slain. Now we locked up again. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states. Working your forms, black nannies carrying your white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars, but you don't ever show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? You never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Worst case scenario, might work, still a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes, cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the rodent's still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, races go. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland Security, now there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Troops still riding, still obliging, still no Bin Laden. Tuned in, waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres. Take these 40 ounces. We ain't gon' get on the levees. Revolution televised early.
American,
is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Forced to climb instead of have your back, have you beat and lost your mind? Especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got pawn shop, gun shop, liquor store sign. SWAT team, crack fiend, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You can't ball, then you forced to grind. If you fall, then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. Since phone calls cost a dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent. Brothers not only dealing with the same drug selling. If I'm a hustler, then what's more American? We all founded on the same thug heritage.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America, I done gave you all that I own. America, took me from my mama so young. America, locked me up and gave me your name.
America, 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 you know the black freedom movement. You know we've been trying to redeem the soul of the nation. Even as that nation been trying to render us soulless, but we are our soulful people, the blues people. We've been keeping alive the bus, same banner of democracy. Thank God for those who came before. We shall never forget them and always move forward with grace and dignity.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America, I done gave you all that I own. America, took me from my mama so young.
All right, America, are you ready for tonight? We have the most outstanding program on the Dr. Mary Lee Live Show tonight. We're going to be talking about Tulsa 1921, the pain and death of racism. We have a special guest, Dr. Tiffany Crutcher, founder of executive and director of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we have also another special guest out of Oklahoma, Senator Connie Johnson. She may have a special announcement tonight. The music you just heard was courtesy of Dr. Cornel West and his record called America. The music was produced by my son, Corey Cochi Tatum. And my youngest son was the first rapper, I Riz the Moment, followed by Rod Digga, Black Thought, and, of course, Dr. Cornel West. I'm Dr. Tatum from California. We have an outstanding show lineup tonight. I'm going to bring on one of our executive producers, Mr. James Cannon, who is the father of entertainer Nick Cannon, who is the ambassador of the Clone Years and Beyond. Mr. Nick Cannon is an international known artist, and his dad, the patriarch of the family, James Cannon. Are you with us, Mr. Cannon? Wait, no, Mr. Cannon. Now we have Michael Times. Mr. Times?
Yeah, I'm here, Dr. Tatum. Can you hear me?
Time is in your hand. We have an exciting program, as I mentioned, Dr. Tiffany Stretcher and also Senator Connie Johnson of Oklahoma. Go ahead. It's in your hand, Michael Times. I'm Dr. Tatum passing the baton.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Tatum. As Dr. Tatum said, my name is Michael. I primarily act as a community advocate for self-sufficiency and socioeconomic opportunity in the Black community, as well as something of an elucidator on issues facing specifically the Black community, such as socioeconomic disparities and impediments within the community to better health, wealth, and opportunity. Before we get into the show, I do want to bring on Dr. Mary Lee so she can give her introduction, and we can bring on the guest and have the guest give their introduction. We can start asking some questions and dive into the show tonight, which I presume will be very interesting and very enlightening. So, Dr. Mary Lee, are you there?
Thank you so very much, and I want to welcome you all. Certainly appreciate you joining us tonight. I'm just looking forward to an exciting and very informative talk tonight. As I always say, we're just sitting in the living room having a good conversation. So we don't consider any arguing to go on. We're just talking. We agree to disagree. We agree to agree. So we want to welcome all. We want to thank our special guests tonight. And first, I'd like to confirm that we have Connie Johnson, former senator of Oklahoma City, on the line. We do have a number here, but we want to be sure you're there. Are you there, Connie Johnson? So are you? Okay. Are you there? Okay.
She may have to push one.
Okay. So if you would tap one on your phone, Connie Johnson, Senator Connie Johnson, if you would tap one on your phone, where we can be certain to have your line open. Okay, and then we're going to ask everyone to mute your phones until you're called down to speak. Okay, so we want to welcome, this is a talk show, and so we welcome our callers to join the conversation, to ask questions. You will tap one on your phone when you're ready to speak, and we will open up your line. Okay, so we are, I don't think I've forgotten anything. I'm trying not to. So we're going to move forward. Our guest tonight is very, very special to us. Dr. Tiffany Hachi Crutcher is a native of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and thrust into the national spotlight following the death of her twin brother, Terrence Crutcher, and I know so many of us do remember, who was shot by a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma, while holding his hands in the air. The murder of her brother compelled Tiffany to speak out against police brutality, particularly the killing of unarmed Black men. She has chosen to turn her personal tragedy into an opportunity to bridge fear, mistrust, and help transform a justice system that has long perpetrated injustice dating back to the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, where mobs of white rioters burned down her great-grandmother's prosperous community known as Black Wall Street. Dr. Crutcher has remained committed to organizing coalitions throughout the country that promote the interests of minority communities. Dr. Crutcher is the founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and the Demanding a Just Tulsa Coalition. The foundation's primary focus is criminal justice and policing reform, providing scholarships to African-American students, community and youth development, and policy advocacy. She is a proud HBCU graduate, but she received a BA, MS, and clinical doctorate from Langston University and Alabama State University. She is a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Inc., and a graduate of the James W. Wright Leadership Development Institute in Montgomery, Alabama. Dr. Crutcher currently serves on the Oklahomans for Criminal Justice Reform, Medcare Foundation, Historic Greenwood Main Street, and Justice for Greenwood Foundation Boards of Directors. Dr. Crutcher is also a member of the United Justice Coalition and a founding member of the Sisters of the Movement, both national organizations. And then there's so much, much more. But we want to welcome you, Dr. Crutcher, and certainly appreciate you joining us. Want to give the floor to you now. I know you've been busy, doing so very much. I know you've had a very long day, so I'm extra grateful for you taking this time out to join us. Would you share with us what your day's been like today, what you've been doing today, Dr. Crutcher?
Thank you so much, Dr. Lee. First, let me say thank you for just reaching out and following up on Dr. Tatum's request. I remember meeting Dr. Tatum just a few short weeks ago in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He came to the sacred hollow ground of Black Wall Street and came into my foundation, the Terrence Crutcher Foundation, and he started educating us, you know, and this conversation was so organic, and he was talking, and he didn't meet a stranger, and we just connected. He gave his number, and I gave my number, and he followed up and called you right away, and you know, said we have to have a follow-up conversation, and you followed up, and here we are. So just after researching and learning about what you all do and what you've done over the years for the community, I'm just honored to be here to have this conversation tonight and excited to learn about Mr. Tynes. And if Mr. Cannon joins us, just, you know, what he's doing in the areas of self-sufficiency. I think that's so important, especially around the issues of, you know, socioeconomic justice, health and wealth and opportunity, because that's what we're missing is opportunity. And so I'm happy to be here. And I'm actually not in Tulsa, Oklahoma right now. I'm in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and decided to get on a plane and come and rally cry for all things justice. And didn't have any meeting scheduled, but I felt like I needed to be here with our democracy that's on the line, our democracy dwindling away. And it has been a heavy day. You know, I've been with the Congressional Black Caucus, and a lot of our freedom fighters, like Representative Maxine Waters and Clyburn, Representative Clyburn and Rochester and Congresswoman Beatty and Edwards out of Detroit and so many others. You know, I was in the office meeting with Representative Cori Bush today, and in my last meetings were with, believe it or not, Senator Cory Booker and Senator Tim Scott's office. You know, we're trying to push this policing bill, this George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, across the finish line. And I feel like, you know, the anniversary of George Floyd has come and gone, and the trial has come and gone, and we've had more and more names, and that they've brushed this legislation, this civil rights legislation, under the rug, because we've moved on to infrastructure, we've moved on to voting rights and the filibuster, and nobody's talking about the sanctity of life and the policing act. And I said, you know, I can't let this die. It will be 5 years in September that my twin brother, Terrence Crutcher, was killed at the hands of law enforcement with his hands in the air, a descendant of Greenwood, a descendant of Black Wall Street, someone who was in church every single week, someone who was in school, had just left school and was killed. And I made a promise when his killer, Betty Shelby, Officer Betty Shelby, was acquitted that I would not rest until I transformed not just policing, but all inequities in this country. And I knew that was a tall order. I knew it was a challenge. I knew that the baton had been passed on generations to generations, and that it was my turn. And so I came out here to rally cry, you know, and ended up today in, you know, my first part of the day in a judiciary committee hearing with, you know, everybody, the Republicans and Democrats, Jim Jordan and all of those folks on the right and all of the folks on the left. And they were talking about sentencing enhancement and trying to reduce crack cocaine and minimize that. I mean, it was just so much going on. And then I ended up in a meeting in the Lincoln Room with all of those great, and then, of course, in meetings with Tasha Brown at Black Voters Matter and Melanie Campbell, and just so many others, on top of all of the meetings, just trying to make them hear us, because those who believe in freedom cannot rest. So it's been a heavy day. I will say this, the policing reform bill is not doing so great. It's dying. You know, Senator Tim Scott said that if we don't get anything done by the end of the month, it's dead. And it triggered me when he said that it's dead, the bill is dead, because my twin brother is dead. My twin brother's dead, and his life isn't about politics. You know, I'm tired of negotiating. If Black people live or die in this country and police brutality has no respect of person or title or education or degree, you can be an NFL player, you can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer, but your Black skin has become a weapon. And they told my brother way up in a helicopter that he looked like a bad dude. Not sure what a bad dude looks like 20,000 feet up in the air, but all I could suspect is that he was Black. And so that's what we're dealing with right now, because I've been to Capitol Hill over and over again, fighting for all of us. You know, I don't care what your issue is, and I tell people every day, Dr. Lee and Dr. Tatum, we have to stop making decisions daily as to who or what issue deserves our outrage. All of these issues of inequity deserves our outrage. So I found myself over the last 5 years on the front lines of economic justice, voting rights, policing reform, criminal justice reform, redlining, right. All of that. And then we end up here 100 years later at the 100-year anniversary of the worst racial terror attack on U.S. soil, bombed by its own government, the decimation of Black Wall Street, one of the most prosperous and vibrant Black communities in the world, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so that's what I've been doing today, and I'm going to be honest, since we're having a living room and a kitchen table conversation, I'm quite exhausted. But, again, I'm honored and excited to learn from you all and have this conversation. And if Senator Johnson comes on, I can just give her the phone, because she's the real queen of Oklahoma. So thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so welcome, and thank you for being here. You know, my passion is entrepreneurship for every person and on the universe, you know, to change the lives of the youth, the disabled, and, of course, us, number one, and, you know, all underserved, in all of our underserved communities. I've been where you are so many times on Capitol Hill. I know those hallways. I know what it looks like. I know what it feels like going from one building to the next building to the next building, talking with our representatives and our senators. I know what it feels like, and I totally understand. And just know that I'm Neighborhood Commerce Institute, Dr. Mary Lee Life. We're here with you. We're here with you, whatever we can do. We're here with you, and I don't just say that frivolously. I mean it from the depths of my heart. You know, yes, it's been a few years, maybe 6-7 years since I've been lobbying, but I will go there with you. I will go there with you, and I have no issues with it at all. I've been, 40 years plus more, 40 years working in the area of economics, in the area of developing businesses, primarily for corporate America. So I understand and know from A to Z, you know, what has happened to us economically and how to access the funding, how to, you know, to capitalize on philanthropy. I've done this, you know, for white corporate America, and now I am doing it for us. Yes, I have to make a few sacrifices to be able to do it, but that's just fine. I know how to raise tens and tens and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. There are so many grants out there for black businesses that we don't know that's there nor how to get it. That's my job. That's my calling. But I will lobby too as well. I will do whatever I need to do. And so I'm here to help nationwide, worldwide. And we've got some awesome opportunities that are coming up in the area of philanthropy. There's so much funding. And so once we can understand this economics and understand that we must operate as one people economically, you know, I often refer to it as economic underground railroad, because one thing for sure, they never expect us as a people to take advantage or utilize philanthropy or the government grants and, you know, the corporate grants. All of the funding that's out there that's available, they don't expect us to ever know how to access it. This is the problem, access. And it's our money anyway. You know, some of us say, oh, you know, I don't want a handout. It's not a handout. It's there. It's been allocated for us. All of us know, many of us know and understand that funding comes into a city. Funding comes in from what's called CDFIs, Community Development Financial Institution Fund. That fund, those fund monies goes into community development corporations. Those community development corporations then decide who gets the money and where it goes. These funds have been allocated from day one to our black communities, to the underserved communities for rebuilding. But what are they doing with it? When we don't go for it, they reallocate it, okay, you know. And we don't understand what that means to the people. But they take that money. White corporations, white America takes that money. White developers take that money and gentrify. That's what they do. You know, they start building up downtown using what's called new market tax credit. And then they'll put in the low-income tax, you know, the low-income home, and they only got to do like a certain tiny percent to make a low income in order to be able to qualify for all that money. Then we've got Brownsville, Neighborhood Commerce Institute, we're established to bring that money into our neighborhoods. That's what I'm here for. That's what I'm fighting for. That's what I'm working for. Because one thing for sure is once we can get control over our neighborhoods financially and develop entrepreneurs, that's what's going to make a difference. And we have, you know, financial power, and then we can go into these communities, and then we can teach our own people what it means to lobby, what it means to be a successful entrepreneur. They don't know how to do it, but Neighborhood Commerce knows how to do it. Neighborhood Commerce is organized and structured in a way to develop all the formwork, all the paperwork. We manage, we do it all. We bridge the gaps. That's what we do. So that any entrepreneur in any community can qualify. Right now, we've got more than 200 billionaires who have, since George Floyd, who have allocated, committed to billions of dollars to the black community, to black entrepreneurship, to building black neighborhoods. Okay, what's going to happen if we don't go for that money? What's going to happen is they're going to reallocate it. Well, not really. They'll give it to others who will in turn say, okay, we're going to use the money over here in Detroit or Philly in Greenwood. But white people will be in control of it because we don't know how to do it. Community Development Corporation, they're like 5,000 of them. Less than 1.5% of these CDCs are operated by blacks. And even less than that percentage control CDFI. And so what Dr. Mary Lee and Neighborhood Commerce Institute is about, we're about bringing these CDs, creating these CDCs, creating and teaching and training in the neighborhoods. That's also going to help. But sister, I love you. I thank you for joining us. I do know that our Senator Connie Johnson is here now, and she's the former senator of Oklahoma City, and will be running for governor of Oklahoma. And I want you to know I'm with you. I'm with you too as well, Mrs. Johnson. Do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us what you've been doing today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm actually in the midst of pumping some gas, but we've spent all day preparing. I need 4504, please. Preparing for the announcement of the campaign tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
Our official announcement. So it's okay. Been a day kind of trying to incorporate all the issues that Dr. Crutcher just talked about, you know, into messaging that speaks to the masses in Oklahoma you know, assures them that we have a better plan, we have a more experienced person, and, mm-hmm. you know, we have a person with a track record that people trust, who, you know, that people know have made a difference before in Oklahoma.
Well, welcome, and thank you for joining us, and so we're now going to turn it over to Michael, and Michael is going to lead out on some questions and the discussion, and he may address his questions either to Ms. Johnson or to Dr. Crutcher, either or. Okay, and then when we see Dr. Cannon joining us, we will ask him to also give his comments. So, Michael, it's in your hands.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that, Dr. Lee. First of all, you know, let me once again welcome Dr. Crutcher and Senator Johnson. Firstly, to start off, because I know we talked a little bit more to Dr. Crutcher, Senator Johnson, once again, thank you for coming on the show tonight. To start off, for the people listening, could you, being that, you know, the anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre passed by not too long ago, around the end of May, could you, you know, share with us a little bit about your origin story and what, if any, connections you have to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and how they relate to what you do now within the community, obviously running for office, and why you chose to run for office?
Sure. For me, Tulsa, it's so indicative of the rich, colorful history that is Oklahoma, that's uniquely Oklahoma, starting from the time of the 1866 treaties, when the Civil War basically ended in Oklahoma Territory with the surrender of the five civilized, or rather the five tribes that had slaves in Oklahoma. And those tribes were required to adopt their slaves into their tribes. They were also required to make land allotments to the slaves. So we know that's now how Greenwood came about, how towns like Tatum, Oklahoma, came about, how more than 51 all-black towns came into being in Oklahoma. Of course, at the time, in the case of Greenwood and even in the case of Tatum, the Indians felt that they were giving their slaves less, you know, quality land that was no good. And it turns out that, you know, it literally Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma, was sitting on a black gold mine. So the 1921 race massacre, to me, symbolizes all of that. And the 2021 recognition and observance, to me, comes at a time when not only did so many not know about it in Oklahoma, so many didn't know about it throughout the world. And now that they are, it's just very interesting that Oklahoma has passed the laws that prohibit the teaching of these kinds of historical facts. So it's out of concern for the waywardness, the direction in which our laws are taking us as a state, out of concern for, like Dr. Crutcher has mentioned, the lack of true criminal justice, overbearing aspects of our incarceration, mass incarceration in Oklahoma, pursuant to the war on drugs. All of that, you know, those form the basis for why I'm running, because I know that economically Oklahoma can do better. We are a land of rich resources, of rich and diverse peoples and groups, and everybody wants the same thing. They want a job that pays a decent wage. They want for their children to be educated in ways that solidify their future chances. You know, they want basic health care. They want to be assured that, you know, in a pandemic, as we saw, that their community's systems of delivery are not found to be so woefully inadequate. Those are three of the principal reasons that I feel, like my girlfriend just told me, that I feel that I can't not run for governor. I have over 40 years of experience in the public sector. I've proposed innovative solutions that have actually made a difference in Oklahoma in terms of being the original author of Oklahoma's medicinal marijuana law, and the good we know that has happened in our state with regard to patients getting the opportunity to have alternative types of treatment, with regard to businesses being able, mom-and-pop businesses being able to thrive and prosper, and with regard to what we still have yet to achieve, and that is equity and social justice towards those whose lives were previously harmed by laws that are no longer in effect, to restore them to their rightful place in society, and in fact, you know, give them a leg up when it comes to being able to engage in this industry. So those are the, my concern as a native. I'm also a native. The level of regard that our state is demonstrating for our relationships with the tribes is unacceptable. There are just so many things that are happening in an administration that, to me, was an experiment. We took a chance with someone who had no background in governance, and it's come up short. So Oklahomans are ready for a change. Coming out of the pandemic, we are devastated. We've been traumatized, and we want to look forward to something different in the future, some leadership that acknowledges the importance of healthcare, that acknowledges the importance of teaching children the truth, that acknowledges that there are opportunities in our infrastructure to develop not only good-paying jobs and sustainable jobs, but workforce and training development opportunities for our young people and those citizens who are returning to society. So those are the issues, I think, that most Oklahomans are most concerned about. I believe we are the right person to not only tell the facts, but to actually make recommendations and propose policies that change those facts and make them better.
Excellent. Thank you. Appreciate that. Before I get into some more questions pertaining more so to some connections between past and present in the context of criminal justice and specifically what we know about the Tulsa race massacre, I want to ask you, you mentioned a fact that I personally didn't know, and I'm pretty sure most of the people listening, or at least a sizable portion of the people listening, didn't know about the history of really Black Wall Street's founding as it related to Native populations owning African slaves and then giving them this land at the behest of, governmental authority. And you said that this was somewhat censored in the education system in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I believe. And I just want to know, how exactly does that censorship go about? How is that done? And why do you think that is?
So Oklahoma, along with several other southern states, has been influenced for years by policies that emanate from a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is a conservative arm association for legislators, that creates legislative proposals that sometimes are, they're standard pieces, and sometimes it's so mundane and the practice that when they present these proposals to legislators and they get them filed, sometimes they forget to change the name of the state in the bill. So this is along with those laws right now that allow people to run over protesters. This is one of a series of legislative proposals going across the country, in addition to the voter suppression proposals that, that they make up a packet. They make up a series of proposals that are designed to, again, limit people's ability to be educated, to express their First Amendment rights. A series of proposals that seriously do question people's liberty and their ability to live a life of freedom and choice. So this is not proposal. This is again something that is going on nationwide.
Okay, appreciate that. And I looked up the organization you mentioned, ALEC, and I'm kind of on the about section on their website, and it says that the American Legislative Exchange Council is America's largest nonpartisan voluntary membership organization of state legislators dedicated to the principles of limited government. And when I read limited government, being somewhat historically limited about American history. That limited government usually ties into states' rights, which is a dog whistle oftentimes to mean that historically, you know, slave-owning states or more conservative states wanted the right to go against, let's say, federal mandates that called for the end of slavery, basically the states' rights to do what they want in opposition to federal government, even when the thing they want to do is considered morally reprehensible. So do you think that organizations like ALEC and others that stress freedom are using that word freedom and using the term limited government as kind of dog whistles, basically just to mean preserving systemic privileges that certain people have been given over others?
Yes, I think the word itself, conservative, denotes things remaining the same. And another piece of interesting history in Oklahoma is that the first bill ever passed here, Senate Bill 1, was the Jim Crow law. Oklahoma officials had, they put it in the Constitution when they sent it to the feds for approval, and the federal government rejected the Constitution several times because of the inclusion of Jim Crow. They took it out, the federal government approved it, and the first bill ever passed in Oklahoma, not a House bill, but Senate Bill 1, was the Jim Crow law. It was about maintaining the status quo. After the territory of Oklahoma was slaves were freed in the territory. Mind you, the slaves were freed in the rebelling states only, in the southern states. Slaves were not freed in states like Missouri, where slavery was legal. They were not freed in the territories. Oklahoma was a territory. Oklahoma slaves only became freed after the Indian tribes conceded behind the Civil War. So keeping things the same, keeping business as usual going, is a necessary prerequisite for us to continue the way we are as a country. And I think, you know, after George Floyd, where the way black folks are treated was on national display. We've seen it so many times with people like Terrence Crutcher. I can name many others in Oklahoma where we're like number two or three in death in police custody. But, you know, the effort to maintain that as the norm is what groups like ALEC exist to do. It's like the Republicans now are not my father and my pastor's Republican. My father was a Republican. My pastor was a Republican. There were many black folks who were Republicans in the 50s and 60s. But this is a different type of entity that we're dealing with now. This is an entity that, above, against all odds, would seek to keep things the same, to keep groups, whole swaths of people suppressed and burdened down and overwhelmed to the point, so much so to the point, that these groups no longer believe their vote counts. We are investing a lot of effort in finding the more than 52% of people in Oklahoma who are not even registered, who are eligible to vote. We're investing in finding them and not only getting them registered, but giving them strategies to ensure that their votes get counted, that they understand that their votes matter. And I'm just excited because this is not something that every campaign will do. But I've long been a student of the legislative process. I worked for 24 years as a Senate staff person, researching and writing the laws prior to actually becoming a senator. And since I left the Senate in 2014, after winning the Democratic Party U.S. Senate nomination, I made history. I lost that race, and only 29% of the people turned up to vote. So coming out of that, my conclusion was that, sure, we had people registered,
They just weren't voting. So I began at that time creating a 100% guaranteed voting program that we share with groups right now in Oklahoma. But we also created pop-ups whereby we can go to any event and enroll people, get people who are already registered to also just apply to vote by mail. We tell them when you apply, you do not have to vote by mail. It simply means that you will get notice of every election 30 days ahead of time, every time, which will give you 30 days plus the day before the election to actually hand deliver your ballot to our county election board between 8 and 5 Monday through Friday as a way to be sure they vote. In 2012, the black community in Oklahoma did not realize that President Barack Obama was up for re-election. And not that he did so good in Oklahoma anyway. We were the first and only original red state in 2008. But, you know, he almost lost in the precincts where we know he would win because of lack of awareness about the fact that it was time to vote. So I'm pretty proud of our effort to not only get people to vote for me, but to get them to guarantee their vote by applying to vote by mail. That's the strategy we're employing.
Absolutely. And what, if any, groups would you be able to point to? Because something that I run into a lot is the extensive, well-funded disinformation campaigns that have been, propagated or used to propagate messages and misinformation into the black community and other communities about not voting. And a lot of the times they'll even use kind of, fake profiles of people in the community, someone who on social media is ostensibly black, but really is, not a black person behind an account to disseminate information, false information, to dissuade people from voting because they know that that actually does confer political power, especially at the local level. So what organizations, what groups, if any, that you're aware of, would you be able to point to as, sources of some of this disinformation about voting that's intended to dissuade people to vote and rob them of their political power?
Not necessarily groups, but definitely processes and systems. The system that prohibits people who have felonies from voting in Oklahoma until the sentence is over, that same system has people in the correction system telling prisoners who are exiting the system that they can never vote again. So misinformation. The fact that there are so many people with felony backgrounds who literally can vote, but who don't know that because there is no concerted push to get them engaged, I think is a failure of the system. When we have people in jail who have yet to be convicted, but their rights to vote are being limited by incarceration and nobody's doing anything about that. When we have people with disabilities who have certain rights under the ADA, but those rights are not being enforced when they go vote. We also found out that they're treated differently with regard to delivering their ballots back to the county election board. So it's a system of a lack of information and misinformation that I think is contributing to it more so than in any serious groups. I just don't see that we have a plan going around telling people they can't vote, right?
Right.
We don't have those systems anymore where people are actually threatened if they vote, where people are given poll tests to determine whether they can vote. I think it's more so a concerted misinformation campaign or lack of information campaign that results in people not participating. And it's a sense of being overwhelmed and traumatized on a day-to-day basis in ways that keep people from believing that their votes matter. It's a systemic operation that's taking place right now.
Yeah, to almost foment hopelessness to make people think like they can't really affect the larger picture in any way because they're too small.
And in fact, they're the only ones who can. We just got to get them to believe it.
Absolutely.
And I think they're ready in Oklahoma. I think people are ready to try something new, to believe in something that's tried and true. And I'm just excited about offering my knowledge and my background and experience and my vision to my fellow Oklahomans. And at the root of that is encouraging them to exercise their civic duty and vote.
Absolutely. I personally think that, you know, the biggest challenge to misinformation is going to be increasing political awareness and doing something about the misinformation that comes from social media, because you have a lot of, in particular, you know, black individuals who on social media, they don't even realize that they're getting disinformation from, I know you said there are no groups, but you mentioned like authority officials, people in the criminal justice system, like, you know, telling prisoners who are being released that they can't vote, or people who are waiting to be convicted that haven't been convicted that they can't vote even when they can. And I know you said there are no groups, but I would say that although that doesn't necessarily indicate a group that meets up in a physical building, that indicates a group of people who are bound together ideologically, at least by, you know, ideology that says they fear racial meritocracy. They don't want everyone having the same privileges that they do. So I think in a sense that, you know, that's the kind of group that does want to suppress the political clout of other populations as a ideological group that doesn't want, you know, equality in that sense. So I would say that
sure.
The biggest problem is getting African Americans to realize that this ideological group of individuals are also online as well, because that's where a lot of the disinformation about voting comes from on social media. You see that these individuals tap into very real and understandable frustrations that African Americans and other groups of people have with the political process, but they use that frustration, they use that anger, and direct it at the system instead of the people who are impeding their progress within the system. And so they think that, well, throw the whole system away, or I shouldn't participate in the system because it's no good, instead of, well, direct my energy towards getting these particular type of people out of the system that are intentionally trying to suppress my vote. And, you know, that goes back to kind of an old, I know you said your father was Republican, and you said that the Republicans have changed now, and that goes back to, you know, an old tactic that comes from the Republican Party of today that came about, I can't remember if it was sometime around the Tea Party, but one of their main strategies for suppressing the political clout of groups they didn't want to gain in society was to do things like defund education, for instance, so that it becomes so inefficient and there becomes so many, there's so much inefficiency there that people recognize the inefficiency and they get frustrated. And when they're frustrated, the Republicans use that energy, use that anger and direct it towards kind of dismantling the system so that we don't have public education at all and it all goes private. So they'll intentionally sabotage the system to make people fed up with how inefficient it becomes and then use their anger at the inefficiency of the system to say, hey, you know, we might as well not even have this thing anyway. Let's make it all private because it already doesn't work. And the people who are angry don't realize that the same people who are selling them or trying to sell them, you know, privatization or dismantling the system are the same people who actually intentionally cause the inefficiency in the system in the first place to get them angry enough so that they would agree with them in dismantling it. So I think that's something that we have to educate the people on.
I think you're exactly right. It's just a horse of another color, same name, right? And
I want to kind of jump in here for a moment here, Mike. Maybe going a little different track. Senator Johnson, were you senator during the killing of Terrence Crutcher?
Remind me what
That was in 2016?
No, was, I left in 2014.
Okay, so you weren't during that time. But I'd like to ask you, you know, as a as with your political power and experience, what were some of the steps that you took personally during that period of time to support Dr. Tiffany and her family? Were there any political actions that you personally, steps that you personally took during that time? And even now, what do you do?
Other than continuing to advocate for people to change the status quo by going to the ballot, to the voting pools and voting, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much when I left public service. I became vice chair of the Democratic Party, and you know, that was like a full-time job in terms of fighting the notions and behaviors of Democrats in Oklahoma with regard to the base. You know, not just black folks, but the people who make up the base of the Democratic Party. For example, we had a gag order put on us in 2015, 2016, that prohibited us from talking about all things Democratic, like women's reproductive rights, abolishing the death penalty, immigration, legalizing medical marijuana. The things that Democrats have traditionally spoken about were actually squashed. And I'm saying all that to say that this dealing with the systemic racism in pretty much every aspect of life in Oklahoma. Again, our foundational bill was the Jim Crow law. For me, was where I continued to focus my efforts. You know, murders by police, over-incarceration of women more than any other place in the world, lack of inclusion when it came to government contracts governing the building of roads and bridges in Oklahoma, health care in general. So all of them have at the root who's in the decision-making seats. You know, what happened to Mr. Crutcher had happened to at least two people or three people I knew in Oklahoma City. One gentleman was handcuffed, laying on the ground with his hands behind his back, and a policeman went up and shot him in the back of the head in front of 30 people. And then they, you know, decided to make a deal and not prosecute the police in return for not prosecuting this man's sister that they made watch as her brother lay on the scorching hot concrete and his blood dried and it rained and his blood flowed down the street in front of her. That was the trade-off for them not holding those policemen accountable. You know, Dane Scott, who was, you know, a target of Bell City policemen, who ultimately shot him in the back and was not held accountable. There, you know, it's just when it rains, it pours in Oklahoma. And in the area of justice and police, biased policing, just one of many areas that as a public policy official, I addressed along with so many other things. So I went to Tulsa during the time as a part of the public uproar and outcry. But other than that, I just I just believe that all of these things can only change mm-hmm. when we change who is making the decisions.
Thank you. I'd like to go to Dr. Tiffany. Dr. Tiffany, did you feel that you, during the time when immediately after the killing of your brother, and you reached out to your public officials, do you feel that enough of support or did you have the ear or enough or lacking their support? How did you feel?
Well, I'll just say that as we, again, encroach the five-year anniversary, I feel like I've had a lot of support. I've had a community of angels that stood with me from day one. I mean, we probably had one of the largest protests that or marches that Tulsa had ever seen. And so I felt like everybody showed up and took it to the streets. What they didn't know is that my mother and father, they've been servants and pillars in the community for decades, and I don't believe they knew who they shot that day. You know, immediately the police spokesperson came out and gave out false information and said Terrence was belligerent and wasn't following mm-hmm. commands, and we demanded at the outset the video, and it was the elected officials, it was the faith leaders, it was the community that demanded, along with mm-hmm. myself, to release the videos. And so I don't believe that we could have done it or I could have done it with the mm-hmm. mind or the mindset that I was in. You know, I was traumatized and living in Montgomery, Alabama at the time and coming home to do it alone. And so, yeah, the mm-hmm. elected officials showed up. I mean, the candidates spoke Terrence's name. I mean, Donald Trump, who was a candidate at the time against Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. they all spoke out against the killing. And believe it or not, Donald Trump made the statement that Betty Shelby choked. Of course, he got some backflow mm-hmm. from the FOP and the police, mm-hmm. and they trained mm-hmm. him up really quick and said, don't ever say that again. But he said she mm-hmm. choked, and if she was scared, she should have never been a police officer. Mm-hmm. It looks like Mr. Mm-hmm. Crutcher did everything right. Hillary Clinton spoke Terrence's name and said, you know, if I'm elected president, we're going to fix the killing of unarmed black people in this country. And then our state reps and our local reps and our former reps, we had over 3,000 people at the funeral. And so, yeah, I do believe we've had the support. Again, it was such a blur because everything happened so fast, and we got on the battlefield and we started rally crying for justice for my brother. And nobody can do it better than his family or than his twin sister. And so it was mm-hmm. just like, mm-hmm. I'm going to do it if nobody does it. I'm going to fight if nobody fights. I'm going to be here. My twin brother, we mm-hmm. were in the womb. We were 3 minutes apart. But I'm mm-hmm. grateful and I'm thankful that I didn't have to do it alone. And so 5 years later, I still have people standing in solidarity with us. I mean, and people called and people showed up and they're still showing up and we're still working and we're still fighting. I'm here in D.C., you know, because I made a promise. And so, yeah, I do mm-hmm. feel like I had the support needed. And I do believe that the culture of organizing and activism has changed and shifted and it's been re-energized. Because I think I've shown the community what consistency looks like, what persistence mm-hmm. looks like, because you have to keep doing this over and over and over and over again. No excuses. A lot of times I find that the black community is reactive. And what I'm trying mm-hmm. to do is develop an apparatus so when Senator mm-hmm. Johnson runs for governor, we don't have to go and scramble
and round people up and try to knock doors. Let's start building the political power now and training up mm-hmm. people and knocking doors now so we can change this poor leadership in our state. We need new leadership, and we need it now. I lost my mother mm-hmm. to COVID-19 right. this past January. Because of poor leadership, because of a governor who thought that this was a hoax, and he caught COVID himself, who wouldn't put a state mandate in place for masks, you know, who misappropriated funds for COVID-19. I lost my mom to COVID-19, and someone who's signing bills into law, 1775, critical race theory, 1674, anti-protest bills, you know, violating our constitutional rights. We need new leadership, and we need new leadership now. And so what I'm trying to do is really build that political power and that community power and transformational power. So when it's time to flip these seats like they did in Georgia, and Oklahoma is different. We different. Mm-hmm. But we are coming, and I'm remaining hopeful, and I'm thankful to God that somebody is stepping up to the plate, Connie Johnson, yet again, to get on that ballot and run for governor. So yeah, the support has been there, and again, you know, I believe it's all about the people and the leadership, and people buy into leadership, people buy into action, and you know. My only motivation is that we are dealing with neglect as black and brown people in this state. And my brother's blood was splattered on the streets of North Tulsa. And I'm going to keep fighting no matter what people say. I'm his advocate, you know, and that's mm-hmm. where we are.
Yeah, you say you're not going to rest until you transform not only Tulsa's policing department, but also the nation. What are the specifics that you're asking for, that you're seeking change?
Well, yeah, well, when we talk about policing, you know, everything is systemic and structural at the end of the day. If we had opportunity, as Mr. Tyne said, you know, we wouldn't really be in a lot of the situations that we're in as black communities across this country, but specifically in the areas of policing, what I'm asking for is for the doctrine of qualified immunity to be repealed or abolished, and for the use of force standard to be lowered, because the standard is too high. We can't really prove what goes on in an officer's head when they say they fear for their life. They're trained to say, I feared for my life. That's why in every case you hear those three words, I feared for my life. Betty Shelby mm-hmm. said on 60 Minutes, I would rather be tried by 12 than to be carried out by 6. He made me do it, and we can't prove what went on in our head, because, you know, you have to prove willful intent, which is a very strict standard. And so what we're asking Congress to do is to lower that standard, and instead of allowing the police officer to say that they acted within reason, which is so subjective, we're asking Congress to change that language to that this officer acted with a reckless disregard. And so if we can lower that standard, then we can get our day in court. They can prove that they didn't, or that they did what they were trained to do. And so those are the two, I think, sticking points. That's sort of what's keeping this George Floyd Justice and Policing Act from crossing the finish line. It's qualified immunity, which shields police officers. It prevents families from getting closure and settlement. And then 242, USC 242, which is the criminal side. Well, we can even get an indictment. Indictments against police officers are far few and in between. Betty Shelby was the first police officer in the history of Tulsa to be indicted, the very first in 2016. And we're talking about a police department that we know was complicit and burning down Greenwood and shooting people with their hands in the air, unarmed black folks, because they were prosperous. I always say that the same police department, Tulsa's police department, that deputized white citizens and Klansmen and allowed Greenwood to burn, is the same police department 100 years later that's
right,
still killing
exactly.
black people. The culture
exactly.
has
still
not changed.
Dr. Crutcher, not to, sorry to interject here, but you just said something I think is very important. I was wondering if you can repeat it so that people listening, you know, comprehend that, and that really sinks into their mind, that during the Tulsa race massacre, city officials deputized white residents that were participating in the mob, in the massacre. They deputized them, made them deputies, and gave them weapons so
yes.
that they could go into these mm-hmm. black areas and kill people and shoot people and burn businesses. I'm curious if you have any information on this. There's some speculation. There's back and forth. Some people say they were used. Some people say they weren't used. Is there any evidence that, you know, bombs dropped from aerial vehicles like planes were used in the destruction of Black Wall Street?
Absolutely. I mean, historical oral accounts, B.C. Franklin, John Hope Franklin's father actually saw the planes looming and turpentine bombs dropping. There's I think one of his excerpts or journals is in the museum here in D.C., the Smithsonian, and he saw that. But, yeah, the National Guard, that's why right now there's an active lawsuit litigation against the Oklahoma National Guard because they were complicit. They dropped bombs. It was the first time in the history of the United States that its own government, America, bombed its own country. And it was against the black people.
Right.
And that was by,
yeah, and so,
you said that was by military, so unconstitutional.
Yeah.
National
yeah,
Guard.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're one of the defendants in our lawsuit. We're suing the National Guard. We have an active lawsuit that we filed last August, led by attorney DeMario Solomon Simmons. Mm-hmm. So the National Guard, and actually during the centennial, just this, a couple of months ago or a few weeks ago, one of the majors, the captain's black guy, actually apologized. He apologized for not doing enough to stop it. And I believe he's in trouble right now. Don't quote me on that, but I hear he's been suspended for coming out and speaking up and apologizing on behalf of the Oklahoma National Guard. And it's so unfortunate. But it took a black man to apologize. And so, yeah, you're spot on that happened.
And I think people listening may not know that, or for anyone who doesn't, the military does not have jurisdiction on, you know, domestic soil unless in special kind of rare instances like what happened at the, you know, attempted coup at the Capitol, the insurrection. That's when, you know, they bring in military troops to supplement the forces. And that was another thing that, you know, a lot of the paucity and forces and police officers at the Capitol was kind of intentional, now that we know that a lot of those police officers were in on it and gave a lot of the rioters information about where to go and how to get into the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the rare instances where you see the military kind of come in on domestic soil and handle things. But that's, for the most part, unconstitutional. They don't really have jurisdiction. So people should realize that when they hear about stories relating to the National Guard dropping bombs on American citizens on domestic soil.
Yeah, I think they did declare martial law at the time, and Senator Johnson can chime in. She's a better historian than I am. But they did declare martial law, and they did set up camps But you did have some that dropped bombs and allowed it to happen. And then after the fact, then, okay, you know, they actually had to tag, you know, the black folks and label them and capture mm-hmm. that said captured Negro. They would have signs that said captured Negro, you know, on them.
Right,
and so,
right.
Yeah.
And this was before. I just had one more comment, and I'll let you get back to, I know, I'm sorry, I didn't. But this was, so just so people know, this was before, you know, you said they had signs like Captured Negro, and they had them with identification and kind of tags and markings. This was before the, you know, the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. So just in case people listening are seeing some parallels between kind of capturing the identification papers, the tagging, that's not by accident, because a lot of our system, as it pertains to suppressing, you know, African Americans, a lot of the way in which that works was actually adopted by the Nazis when they, you know, had meetings and conversed with American political figures, and they modeled the system that they used to suppress Jews off of the system that America used to suppress Black people. So I just think that people should keep that in mind when they hear things like that, that kind of run parallel to other things they know about in different places around the world, like Nazi Germany, that they are connected.
Wow, absolutely.
Thank you. We do have Dr. Cannon on, so we want to give him the floor, and then we will also ask our audience to please tap 1 on your phone if you have a question or comment, and we will open up your line. Okay, just tap 1 on your phone. Okay, Dr. Cannon, and then we'll come back.
Outstanding, Dr. Lee. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Beautiful. To our guests today, to the audience, this has been some incredible conversation. You know, it seems like, you know, so much information has come out over the in the recent years. This is James Cannon. My home is San Diego, California. You know, a lot of the young people in California don't really understand the history of our people in this country, the mixture of our people from Native Americans coming out of Oklahoma, as well as those that came on slave ships. We had many Indian women that were called Negroes there in Oklahoma. We have a strong history of Indian-Black relations coming out of Oklahoma. You know, as we look at the Bible Belt being right in the location of where many of the uprisings and massacres took place in the middle of the Bible Belt, when we look at, you know, explaining to our young people our history, getting them to understand really what took place, not throwing rocks or throwing stones, being able to look at the history honestly. And then I'm curious of two things. I'm curious if you could answer, and I've had a chance to listen, but more directly, the realistic possibility of, particularly what happened with Dan Tulsa, being able to bring people up on charges to right the wrong, not just an apology from people, but being able to really bring, you know, like even with the Emmett Till situation where this lady is still alive, and she's, from what I understand, made statements that it was a lie, and that young man, but, you know, not for, for vengeance so much, but for justice in that sense. So how do we reconcile that with the conversation of the critical race theory that appears to shut down any conversation about our history, something that has come out, you know, seemingly mainstream conversation, but yet, you know, affects all of this conversation. It brings fear to people wanting to talk. How do you handle the two questions, the realistic possibility of bringing those that are still alive up on charges and to get reparations for those properly? And then how do we put this conversation mainstream where the whole world needs to know? Again, like youth in California, but now we're knew very little about the suffering and the pain, you know, of those in the southern states. But now the whole nation has an opportunity to be exposed, and we have an opportunity to have great dialogue and conversation. But now we see people don't want to have the conversation because it appears that they can lump all of this conversation in with a critical race theory conversation. I'm just curious of your thoughts on those two things, whether we can get due process, and then how do we have this, should we have a critical race theory conversation is my question.
Well, I think, this is Dr. Crutcher, I'll yield to Senator Johnson on that because I would be interested to see how, as a candidate for government, how she would handle that. But I can say, is there a pathway to victory on reparative justice? Again, we filed a lawsuit. I'm actually on the board of directors for Justice for Greenwood, which is a foundation that seeks to hold the entities responsible for the massacre, which is the city of Tulsa, the Tulsa Chamber of Commerce, Tulsa Development Authority, the National Guard. We have three living survivors. They are living at the age of 107, 106, and 100. You may have seen them testify before Congress. I actually had the honor and the privilege to travel with them to Congress and be in that room and listen to them testify. I mean, and they were with it, sharp. And I actually testified that same day on the second panel as a descendant. My great-grandmother's community was burnt to the ground, and I'll never forget that moment. I'll never forget the moment that Hughes Van Ellis, a World War II veteran, when he said, "Don't let me leave this earth like the other survivors without justice. I fought for this country, an all-black brigade, and I came back to be treated like nothing, but I still have faith in America." And there wasn't a dry eye in the room. And for Mother Fletcher to say, "I still smell smoke and I still, you know, hear the screams and I still see the dead bodies in my mind." And for Mother Randall to say, "I still, or I believe that I deserve justice." If that's not the pathway to victory, I don't know what is. But what we've done is instead of, because, you know, with the statute of limitations, survivors went to the Supreme Court. I think it was back in 05 or 07. Olivia Hooker was there, Otis T. Clark, Wes Young. And they said that the statute of limitation had ran out. And they gave them a gold medallion. That was it. But they gave us a charge and told us to never give up. But they gave us a gold medallion. They said, never give up. And so we felt like it was our duty to keep fighting. And so instead of going the reparations route, because you can't bring the same lawsuit twice, we decided to use this pathway and use the public nuisance argument, the same argument. And you may have seen Johnson & Johnson just today nationwide, you know, settled for $26 billion for the opioid crisis. And just in another state alone, and they said that it was a public nuisance that this opioid crisis caused. And so we're using that same argument, that same angle, and they paid out billions. In Oklahoma, I think Johnson & Johnson paid out, I don't know if it was a half of a billion or a billion, I'm not sure the exact number, but that same formula fits what happened to Greenwood. It was a public nuisance that took place, the continued harm, the continual harm that still exists 100 years later. We own nothing in Greenwood. You look at the map, it wasn't just a block. It wasn't just a street. It was a community. It was 40 square blocks, churches, businesses, schools, doctor's offices. If you come to Tulsa and drive the boundaries, it was huge. They leveled it to the ground. And now we own nothing. There may be one or two churches that's still owned by black people. The businesses,
you know,
lease them. And, you know, and my, so, my, go ahead.
you know, my heart hurts in that in a lot of ways. Is there videotape or was that presentation taped where they were able to testify? Is there any way that we can get that?
Yes, if you Google it, if you Google the survivors testifying before Congress, it was everywhere. All eyes were on that hearing that day. I mean, it's just amazing. And all eyes was on Tulsa just a few weeks ago. So, I mean, you will be blown away to hear their testimonies. And, I mean, can't help but shed tears.
I still like to engage the conversation on how we address this, you know, because my son Nick Cannon, you know, had an opportunity to go mainstream with the conversation that really offended the Jewish community because of some statements that he made, and he had to apologize, and he made some apologies. And, you know, when we look at the fact that, you know, what we're talking about is murder and massacre that took place, and it's a shame that we would have to litigate down to a public nuisance, that it created a public nuisance, the fact, whatever the limitation would be, there should be no limitation on something so drastic. And, you know, I think as the nation, you know, really understands what took place, you know, the Jewish community very wisely will shut down any conversation that they think and they consider to be anti-Semite. And they'll shut it down, and they'll come collectively and shut it down. Or where they need to open it up, where they figure they need to open up the conversation because they've been disrespected. You know, it's a shame that we have to relegate our hate, hurt, and pain down to the lowest common denominator, when really we should be able to, you know, get the world to understand.
But we need to do something to stop them from shutting the conversations down. That's what we need to do as a people. We should be able to speak.
The critical race conversation, and that I was trying to say, is that the consensus of everybody? I'd like to hear from the senator, but is that the conversation of everybody, that when you hear anything that appears to be talking about the pain and suffering, the systematic racism in our systems, it's gotten better by sure, but there's a whole lot still left to talk about. Are we going to let them put this label of critical race theory to shut down the whole history of our conversation?
Senator Johnson?
Yes. So with regard to teaching critical race theory, there are far-reaching and unacknowledged consequences of failing to teach critical race theory. For example, there are other things that happened in history in Oklahoma that have sensitive aspects to them. For example, the yearly reenactment of the Oklahoma land run, where thousands of acres of land in Indian territory were open for settlement based on who could stake a claim first. And, of course, we know that's where the term Sooners came from, because some people jumped the gun. But, you know, we really focus on educating our children, and you know, it has to be a collective proper. We teach what's correct in our schools. Real history does not go away with fake facts. Literally, it amazes me that anyone would believe that the truth would not come forward about 1921, that they could squash it forever. And that's just not the way history is. You know, if we don't do something about it, you know, the age-old saying, we're doomed to repeat it. So our campaign, you know, rather than focusing on the weeds, it's really just about educating our children and teaching them what's correct. and that has to be the priority.
Well, you know, I know it's a hard conversation, you know, and I think to divide the conversation, if anyone was to say that all white people are devils based on the history of what's taking place in this country, then I would say that would be extreme. And that's not what we're saying as we point out our history. Just as the Germans, the Jewish people, if they say that, you know, all Germans are devils, I don't think that's what they would want to say. What they would want to say is that the history of what took place with them in the country of Germany was an atrocity. It was awful what took place, and they want to talk about it, and they have a slogan: "We're never going to forget. We'll never forget." And so, with that, are we wrong? And it appears that, you know, and I guess what I wanted to be able to do, Senator, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the United Nations report on reparations. It was done in 2015. There was a panel that came from the United Nations, the working group. They came into the United States, and they went to all the southern states, talked to many people, visited the prisons, and they gave a report and recommendations that Afro-American people should receive reparations immediately. And they lay out reparation recommendations. They talk about 264 years of slavery. They talk about Jim Crow, the black laws, and mass incarceration. And with that, in the United Nations report, they say that we should, Afro-American Negro people should receive reparations immediately. Very few people seen that report. And I think if we brought that to the table, that wouldn't be expressing so much a critical race theory as it would be bringing forth the critical race fact, where a body outside of the United States, sent by the United Nations, took a look at all these issues, and they published a report in 2015. Very few people, even in office or out of office, have seen the report, responded to the report. So I'm going to, with a few other powerful to bring that report to the table so we can have more conversation about it, as well as the Mullahan report from 1968, which talks about the devastation of the Afro-American family if you take the black father or the fathers out of the home. I think, you know, these reports are not theories, but these are facts. These are facts that not Afro-American people have, but other ethnic groups have looked into it honestly, and they published these reports. And so to bring forth the critical race facts, I think we need to talk about that. I think we need to be able to look at some facts and say this is what happened, just like the good Jewish people will say this is what happened, and they demanded reparations, and they got it. It's an intellectual conversation. Once we look at the facts,
okay,
we don't have to argue.
Okay.
We don't have to get emotional. We look at the facts, and the facts will help
okay.
us where we go in the future. Dr. Lee.
Okay. Thank you so much. We do have some questions or comments from our audience, and so we would like to open up the line. Erico 314-4600, you are live.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good evening.
Question. Good afternoon. Good evening.
Yeah. Is this the lady whose brother was killed by the patrolman? Patrol person?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
doctor,
I'm sorry to hear.
Tiffany Christian.
Yeah, I've talked to her before. I think that was very sad what happened. And I think it was a tragedy. But I don't want to talk about these other things. What we call in Tulsa, what is Tulsa? Does it sit in Creek or does it sit in Cherokee territory? I think it sits in Cherokee territory, doesn't it? Right there on the border between the two nations?
Yes, you are correct.
What you call them Black Wall Street was actually Creek territory. Because Oklahoma didn't become a state until 1907. And in Creek society, you know, you had Black Creek, Red Creek, and later on, much later, you had White Creek. But in their society, nobody owns the land. The land is for the society itself. Case in point, there in East Tulsa, East Oklahoma, there in Wagner County, when they done those allocations of 160 acres, you had a Creek young lady. She was Black. Her name was Sarah Reckner. And look at the money that she was making from leasing her land out to Standard Oil. She was making to the equivalent today over $5,000 a day for leasing, for the oil, for them to pump oil off of her land. So the guys say we need to have critical race facts. You're right. Much of that land was Creek and Cherokee land, just like down in the South. In Alabama, it was Chickasaw. In Georgia, it was the Creek. And over there in Florida, it was Seminole and Creek. I think Oklahoma consists of Seminole, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Choctaw, and can't think of the name. It's the Muscovy Creek. So people aren't telling this history right. The 40 acres in the mule, the government couldn't give that land to the slaves because it belonged to the Indians. So let's get some critical facts, like the gentleman said, and that changed the whole perspective of the outcome. Once again, I'm sorry of the loss of your brother. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think we may have spoken on another radio broadcast, Dan Mason, maybe. If I'm not mistaken, if you're out of St. Louis.
We might have, but, you know, it's still a tragic to what happened to her brother.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. But understand, again, I think we may have mentioned this earlier, and Senator Johnson, if you want to chime in, I'm not the best historian when it comes to the freedmen's, but again, if you look at the treaties of 1866 and the allotments, I mean, Blacks came on the Trail of Tears with the natives. We were slaves to the natives, and we owned land. A lot of the land over in Greenwood was unclaimed at the time. It was unclaimed at the time, and a lot of Blacks came and migrated to Oklahoma. Oklahoma actually should have been an all-Black state, as Senator Johnson said at the outset. I mean, there were over 50 Black townships. Oklahoma has more Black townships than any other state in the Union. And so a lot of people don't know that history. I didn't know it. They didn't teach us even about the massacre in school. And I went to some of the best schools. I went to Carver Junior High that sits on Greenwood. I went to Booker T. Washington, which was the high school in Greenwood at the time, and they've moved it. And now they call it Tulsa, Washington. They don't even call it Booger T anymore. And they never taught us about it in Oklahoma history whatsoever.
Are you a descendant of the Freeman yourself? Because the Freeman disappeared, last died out in the 1930s. And I think what people are looking at is skin color. The people that you're calling the African Americans are actually Creek. That's a whole different sovereign country.
You
and
have
what a confusion.
You have Creek freedmen. You have Chickasaw freedmen. You have no, and it has.
Well, they still,
to do
but
with.
They still, they Creek freedmen, because Creek had slaves. Creek had slaves back in the 1700s, actually. And your Seminole was some of your most profitable slave catchers. Matter of fact, the Creek was wealthy. They wasn't poor. When they left Florida on the Trail of the Tears, they didn't walk. They rode in steamships with their slaves. And when the time came to ask them, did they want to be American or did they want to stay, they said, we're going to be Creek. So I think that's where the confusion coming on. People are looking at skin color. And you're actually looking at people of another nation. Those are not Americans. Those are Creek Indians. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I had a question just for clarity then. In the slaves that were taken by the Indians, most of our limited understanding is that they were treated, they were married into those tribes, they were not treated as bad as the white man treated his slaves. I'm just asking, you know, coming out of the understanding where a lot of Indians in the area of Oklahoma, does the history say that our Indian brothers treated us with respect, or did they treat us as well like slaves and they were the masters?
Could I interject something? My name is Dr. Dorsey and Spartner Littles. And
okay,
I'm so glad you're on, Dorsey.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Good. Okay, yes, I was just letting you know that you were next up.
The real historian. Go ahead.
Great.
First of all, when the five slave-owning tribes left the South and were sent to Oklahoma, Oklahoma was a territory without a name. However, there were Indian tribes already here, so this land was already occupied. So some of the tribes fought the tribes that were coming in, and some of them moved around because they were nomadic. But there were already Native Americans here, and some of those Native American tribes were already in the area that became Tulsa, the Osage, for example. And Tulsa was the home of the Creek and the Cherokee nations. So they both coexisted. But the point I want to make is when they left the South, they were allocated so much land in Oklahoma so that they were told that that was their land. Each tribe had so much acreage land when they came to the state. However, the tribes, when the Civil War came, the tribes, each one of the tribes of the five civilized tribes or slave-owning tribes, each tribe was divided. So you had Cherokees that were on the south side, you were Cherokees that were on the north side, and that pertained to all five tribes. When the Civil War ended, and as Senator Johnson said, the Civil War actually ended in Oklahoma in July of 1866 when the last tribe signed a treaty ending their part in the war. Regardless of what side the tribes fought on, government, U.S. government decided to punish them for participating in the war in the first place. So they took land away from them. So they lost a considerable amount of land because they participated in the Civil War. Now, some of that land was opened up to the land runs, the land rushes. Now, Tulsa itself, 40 acres of land was bought by a man named O.W. Gurley, and he started selling parcels of land, the 40 acres. That 40 acres was North Tulsa. So North Tulsa was bought by a black man from the South named O.W. Gurley, and he started selling parcels of land. Now, and Senator Johnson was correct, some of the land that was ceded to the freedmen, and freedmen were given varying amounts of land. If you were a freedman, you got less land, and a freedman was a person who was of black descent, or they were of Indian and black descent. But if your mother was black and your father was Indian, you were considered a freedman or a black person, and you got less land. If your mother was Indian and your dad was black, then you were considered Indian. And so the people that were considered by blood on the Dawes Commission roll they received upwards of 160 acres per person when they were given, when they were freed from the tribes and were given their own land. So there were people that had a considerable amount of money, I mean a considerable amount of land that they inherited because they were freed from the tribes and were given land to make themselves independent. The man that developed North Tulsa, and so I'm not sure where he, who he bought the land from, whether he bought it from the Creeks or the Osage or who he bought it from, but the land came from the Native Americans, but it was bought by a man named O.W. Gurley, who sold those parcels of land. The land was not particularly, was not that bad, considering, but some of the other land that the tribes gave to the freedmen was of poor quality. Some of it had gas coming up out of the ground, which means you couldn't plant on it because the gas would kill the corn or the whatever, wheat or whatever was trying to grow. So they thought they were giving them bad land and not fertile land. But as Senator Johnson mentioned, that land proved to have oil. And so there were oil wells on a lot of freedmen's land that was producing upward of 2,000 and 3,000 barrels a day. So that was the source of a lot of Greenwood's wealth, was that there were so many black people who had money as a result of farming or having oil. And the surrounding towns fed into Greenwood because people wanted to have a place that they could shop and entertain themselves comfortably. So there was a lot of money flowing through Greenwood. There's been upward estimates that the dollar flowed in Greenwood around 50 to 100 times before it left the community. And
wow.
I'm talking all over the place.
No, this is really good, and you're spot on. I actually have one of my colleagues and sisters and freedom fighters who has been an advocate for Greenwood for years, who's a Creek freedman, who has one of the largest allotments. And I just wanted her to come on just for total clarity, and everybody is somewhat accurate, but I have Christy Williams. You may have seen her on CNN or MSNBC, and I will say next Tuesday, Congresswoman Maxine Waters will be holding a hearing regarding the Creek freedmen, and they'll be there, and the attorney, DeMario Solomon Simmons, who's representing the Black Creeks, will be there or here in D.C. Next Tuesday. And so I just wanted for Christy Williams just to say hello and just share her story and a little bit about the history. She's a historian, a Greenwood historian, and she can validate or refute some of the things that were said, just so you all will know, and she's a trusted historian. So, Ms. Christy Williams, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I just wanted you to say hello to everyone and just share your story and just a little bit of history. Christy is one of the co-founders of the Real Black Wall Street Tour, and she talks about, because you can't talk about Greenwood without talking about this history and about the allotments and the treaties and the creeks and O.W. Gurley. And so I just wanted you to just share a little bit about that history.
Sure. As Dr. Crutcher said, my name is Christy Williams, and I am a Creek freedman. My great-great-grandfather was Jesse Franklin, who came to Oklahoma before it was Oklahoma, when it was Indian Territory, on the Trail of Tears as a slave to the Creek Nation. And in 1866, when he was emancipated, he became the first African Supreme Court justice to serve in the Creek Nation Supreme Court. There is books about him that tells his story, but he was also a preacher. I mean, he also started a school. His legacy is just amazing, and the, what I heard when I got on the call was accurate from what I heard the young lady who was speaking. You were absolutely right. And, you know, in 1979, they kicked the black people out of the tribe. And all that my great-great-grandfather has worked for, the Creeks do not honor him or tell his story. And I am, you know, when I apply to in the Creek Nation, I'm denied because of the color of my skin. And it doesn't matter what my people went through, I'm still denied. And my family has owned a little over 560 acres of land in Tulsa. My great aunt Janie, who was also a Creek freedman, who was in the Dreamland Theater when the massacre happened of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, her land allotments was at 61st and Yale in Tulsa, where the Hyatt Hotel sits on and the Starbucks, and that was her land. And as you know, when Oklahoma became a state, the first law was Jim Crow, and then there were laws and ordinances that was created to take land from black people in Oklahoma. So there's a story to tell, and I'm just thankful that I could be here today and just share a little bit of my story.
We appreciate you so very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I also want to mention a little bit about critical race theory. I think everyone who talks against critical race theory should be made to define it because they don't know what they're talking about. Critical race theory is laws that were written historically from almost the beginning of what is now the United States of America. They were written to deny African Americans as well as other minorities their rights. It was written to give white people advantages over other groups. And so, critical race theory, Derek Bell, the founder, and he outlines how all of the laws, economically, educationally, how all of those laws were written to make people second-class citizens. So if you want to understand why white people have wealth that's 10 to 20 times the amount of the average black family, you have to understand critical race theory. If you want to understand why the education system has failed minority children and does not fail white children, you have to understand critical race theory. If you want to understand the health disparities between minorities and whites, you have to understand critical race theory. And this is why people want to deny it. The term was coined, not coined, but mentioned offhanded by a president who probably has not read a book since 1960. So he probably heard and kind of got a gist of the meaning, but he didn't even understand the meaning of the word. So like lemmings jumping into the sea, all of the Republican governors have jumped on the bandwagon and banned the teaching of critical race theory in schools because they do not want little white children to feel bad about their race, about their color. They don't take into consideration all of the centuries of little black children, mm-hmm. little native.
Right.
Suffered under the laws that are critical to their well-being. So I think that there should be a real discussion about what critical race is, the definition of it, and what it illuminates the history of this country in a way that has never been illuminated before. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
If I could interject for a second. Just to comment off of that and provide maybe a little bit of pushback, which I usually don't do, but I'm curious as to if you really think maybe do you think that they are opposing this because they want white children or they don't want white children to feel bad or because they don't want the possibility of white children, you know, understanding the socioeconomic structure of America more so to the point where they'll be less inclined to actually participate in maintaining white supremacy and white privilege? Do you think it's more so that they don't they fear like a self-hatred, or they just fear that their knowledge would decrease their participation in keeping white supremacy going? Because I personally, and we can disagree on this, I personally don't think it has. I think that's a cover story that Republicans say, like, oh, this is making white kids hate themselves. But in reality, it's making white kids less likely to participate in maintaining white privilege if they, you know, have some embarrassment, not self-hate, but embarrassment at, understandable embarrassment at the privileges white people have had to, needed to codify into law to give themselves when they couldn't compete equally and fairly with black people. So do you think it's fear of self-hatred, or more so fear of just not as much, not as many troops to fight on the side of white supremacy in the battle of, you know, evolution, really?
I think that they don't want to educate children about how their privilege came about. And so, and because if they found out about it, and by the way, if I was going to read, but I'm not, but if you want to, you can read the statute in Oklahoma. It specifically says that they do not want children to feel badly about themselves. I'm paraphrasing. But not only that,
the governor said, quoted Martin Luther King, children shouldn't be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I had to put out that disclaimer.
Right. It's a Republican appropriation of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. They try to do it all the time, mostly because they're dead and they can't, you know, respond back to them. But I really do think that's just a talking point to rile up white parents. The whole thing about they fear self-hatred, I really doubt that they fear self-hatred. I think they fear their troops and the war of white supremacy declining, that if people, their children know about the
if
fact
they really
that
knew the truth,
their success
right.
came from privilege and not from them outcompeting black people, but rather from them being so scared of black people outcompeting them that they need to write laws to give themselves privilege. If they knew that, that wouldn't create self-hatred. That would create embarrassment, because no one likes to be given a victory, right? If you're in a boxing match and, you know, you know that your coaches and the event organizer and the trainers are all in on a conspiracy because they don't believe you can beat the guy you're going up against, so they load your gloves with bricks or something or plastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might win, but you don't feel guilt after that. You feel embarrassment kind of for the fact that they pretty much validated it. They think that you're too weak to handle it. So I think that embarrassment is what they're kind of fearing, because that would lead them to stop participating in white supremacy and perpetuating it, because no one likes to feel like they're kind of a privileged handout charity type case.
Right, I agree with you.
Today, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What do you think, Christmas?
I agree with the gentleman there. You know, they have to uphold this white power Christian structure that they have created, and by teaching the truth of how this country was created, and this system that was created to control and to continue the practices of white supremacy, these kids these days, learning this history, they're going to change that.
This is exactly what
that was, and I'm just so glad that you spoke to that. I didn't catch the gentleman's name, but I'm glad that you spoke to that, because that's exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Especially with this young generation that is resistant. You know, we're living in this generation, I forget what it's called, XYZ, whatever. But it's a resistance that the youth have today. I mean, none of them, whether they're black, white, or whomever, do not want to conform to the status quo, or they don't want to be told what to do. And so when they find out, you know, the truth, and I've had them say, I've seen them and talk with a number, and they said, well, I had no idea, you know. And I have nieces and nephews, you know, of different races and with different friends. And these young people of today are not, you know, for it. They really, really do want to know. They want to know the history. They want to know the truth. And as Michael just said, you know, they want to feel that they're winning, you know, on their own accord on their own abilities. Families of the parents who, you know, paid, you know, for their children to go to the Ivy League schools, and you know they didn't go through the acceptance traditionally, but it was their degrees and their educations were purchased, and some of them didn't even know it. Some of them didn't even know it, and they didn't appreciate it after the fact. And so I totally agree. Let's see. We are going to we're winding up and winding down. So this could go on. I know for even a couple more hours. So we've got to get you back. And you know, next time we plan on being on TV, and so we'll all be seeing. But I do want to go to Dr. Tatum and Dr. Cannon. We want to start wrapping things up. Then we want final comments from our guests, including Christy Williams and Congress and our Senator Johnson and our Dr. Crutcher would be the last. And then just before Dr. Crutcher, Michael, I would like after Dr. Crutcher, I would like for Michael to kind of wrap it up. But certainly appreciate you, all of our callers and listeners. Certainly without you all, there's no Dr. Mary Lee. This has been great. So Dr. Tatum, thank you so much.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Lee. Just outstanding program tonight, Dr. Mary Lee Live. I'm speaking about the Tulsa Massacre and also the pain Dr. Crutcher going through with her brother that lost his life, brother's parents. And Senator Connie Johnson definitely supporting me to be governor of Oklahoma. Thank you for being on, Dr. Little. All those are listening. I just wanted to let everyone know that unless we take an opportunity this year, with the H.R. 1242 being extended, which is Nick Cannon is ambassador. His father, James Cannon, you just heard him. He is the president of Nick Cannon Foundation. I work as a director of his organization, and our goal is to raise $1 billion plus, even $10 billion, to give to the commission to disseminate and grants to tell the stories, the music, film, art, in every form of communication about the true story. Not the daughters of the Confederate when they erected all these false monuments, but to tell the true story of African American. My hat is off to you, Dr. Lee. My prayers are for all those that are participating on this line to help tell the story correctly and to articulate who we are as a people. Thank you, Dr. Tatum, California.
Thank you, Dr. Tatum. Dr. Cannon.
Beautiful. I appreciate it. It's been an outstanding show. I just want to follow up with Dr. Tatum. I want to appreciate everybody for coming tonight. It's been incredible. Again, you can listen to these shows over and over again on your social networks as Dr. Lee pushes it out. It's really a great opportunity to just continue the dialogue. One of the things we wanted to do with the H.R. 1242 400-year commission is to write books as well. So we're saying nothing over 100 pages, y'all. This is some incredible conversation week after week. And if we can put in publication like Chicken Soup for the Soul did with all of their books, and then this year talk about 400 years of greatness, that's really the emphasis, that we are a great people. Everything that's been thrown at us, all of our history from 400 years and beyond, we've proven that we are a great people. So I say let's write about it. 400 years of politics, 400 years of pro-life, 400 years of entrepreneurship, 400 years of preaching, 400 years of the Spirit of God, 400 years of strong, powerful women in this nation, black women, Indian women, all of us, 400 years of greatness. I just simply want to say Amazon has given us an incredible opportunity. Just like everybody is setting platforms up all across the nation on YouTube and Amazon and Zoom and Blog Talk Radio. I think we also really need to set up opportunities of publishing to tell our story. That's what the commission's whole purpose was, to tell the story. So like one person said, we got to write, y'all, and we got to write hard. Booker T. Washington, born in slavery, but he wrote 9 books. Mary McLeod Bethune, born in slavery, she wrote 9 books. Now we have tools where we can literally put a book out every month if we wanted to. We could come together and we could create series of books that tell our story so that our children and our young people won't have to go to other people to hear, that we can pass it down. And in this age, it can become profitable, because if you sell a book at $10 in it and you sell 100,000 copies, and ladies and gentlemen, it can also affect your finances, but we got to be proactive with the tools that we have. Dr. Lee, this is Outstanding Show. We want to do more of this. Michael, Dr. Tatum, appreciate all of y'all. This is Outstanding to our guests. Keep coming back again and again. We appreciate all your synergy, all your energy. It's been Outstanding Show. James Cannon, appreciate it.
Thank you so very much, Senator Johnson.
Yes, thank you so much for the opportunity to participate and just, you know, have my awareness further enlightened by everyone who's joined the call tonight. I am asking everyone to go to our webpage, govconnie.com, and sign up for regular updates. It's under construction. We are officially announcing the campaign tomorrow at the site of the original oldest high school in the state of Oklahoma, the Frederick A. Douglass High School, and in Tulsa at the Center of the Universe, and followed by a reception at the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame. So everybody in the sound of my voice is invited to be there with us tomorrow, and to definitely support the campaign by voting and visiting the webpage and hopefully throwing a penny or two our way. We need funding, and we believe we have the upper hand in this race, that God will provide the resources, and through programs like this of raising awareness, we can let more people know how important this election will be.
Absolutely. And Dr.
Thank you.
If it's any way possible, if Dr. Tatum could reach back out to her as well, we want to write with her. We want to help her take this all the way to the top and
absolutely
with the media format.
Absolutely.
So if we can double back and have to reserve the privilege to double back and have a conversation and getting some stuff in writing, I'd like to get – we're finishing this book, Dr. Tatum and I, with critical race facts and, you know – I think it'd be a good eye if we could look at that together. So I appreciate that, too. I want to put that on the table.
No
absolutely
problem at all.
Thank you
so much. Could you repeat your website, please?
Sure. It was Connie, G-O-V.
Okay.
G-O-V, Connie, CONNIE.com, govconnie.com.
Okay. That's G-O-V dot. CONNIE.com. No. Okay.
No dot. No dot. Gov. G-O-V.
GovConnie.com. Okay, great. Okay, got it.
One dot.
So GovConnie.com. Okay, we got it. All right, thank you so very much. And we are with you.
But thank you, Dr. Tatum and Dr. Cannon. I'd sure like to take you up on that. We talked about that previously, and this is a story that needs to be told. It's an amazing
Amen.
Story I'd be happy to share. Thank you.
Amen.
That's great. Thank you. I want to remind everyone that Neighborhood Commerce Institute is established to establish businesses, to expand businesses, to bridge the gap between your getting funding, you know, qualifying for funding. And so what we're doing right now, we're going to go and ask these billionaires who have committed, you know, who have said that they're going to support the black community entrepreneurs, the black women, the black men, to build in these neighborhoods. So we're going to challenge them at that. We're seeking 400 entrepreneurs per state to join Neighborhood Commerce Institute in this endeavor. And we will be literally going to these billionaires on our entrepreneurs' behalf from every single state. We're holding a conference call. I'm going to give you that phone number now. On Friday, this Friday at 7 p.m., to explain more how to become a part of this collective nationwide. The conference call number is 605-475-4700. The access code is 848-092-pound. Okay, so again, you're invited to join us on a very important business grant conference call this Friday, July 23rd, 2021, 7 p.m. Dial 605-475-4700. Access code is 848-092-pound. And you can share this if you'd like to get our flyer and distribute it. Just text 712-515-1193 and just say meeting flyer, and then we will forward you the meeting flyer in order to share it with anyone in any state. Again, that number is 571-251-5193. Thank you so much.
That's 7 p.m. Eastern time, Dr.
That's 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Okay, so we are going down to Christy Williams.
I just want to say thank you for having me on this show, and I am so thankful to hear you all speaking to this history. And I always tell people that Greenwood and Black Wall Street belongs to every black person in this country, because those ancestors left a blueprint for us to follow, and that blueprint not only involves that black entrepreneurial spirit, but it's community, it's building, and they left us that blueprint, and every black person has a responsibility to revitalize it and to uphold and honor the legacy, and I can't stress that enough. And just alone, and I won't just speak for Creek Freedmen, but I will speak for all freedmen, because Oklahoma does have a unique story and a great contribution to black history, period. And as we talk about reparations in H.R. 40, we also have to fight these tribes, which is like a whole different, it's on a whole different level, but it needs to happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm thankful that these stories, our stories, are told to people across this world, because now it's really time to really pay attention to our history and to not let what our ancestors fought for and lost to be in vain.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thank you. We're so happy you're here. We appreciate your contribution, and we're here for everyone. Dr. Tiffany.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry. I'm finally walking outside in D.C. Just to try to find a bite to eat at this late hour. But just want to say thank you just for this platform. I believe that iron sharpens iron, and to all of the insight and the contributions on tonight. I just feel that this show is a breath of fresh air where we can actually sit down and and have a kitchen table conversation about issues that truly matter. I'm not going to take up any more time, and you all can Google our story, Google our website, but I want to yield, and I would be remiss if I didn't just promote a young man in Oklahoma who's on my heart and mind right now, who's on death row in Oklahoma, Julius Jones. I want to yield the rest of my time to promote the efforts to get him off of death row. Mm-hmm. He has the final part in parole board hearing on September the 13th, and we are on a final push to save his life. It is the same week that Terrence was murdered. I can't bring Terrence back. We can't bring our ancestors back and our survivors back from Black Wall Street, but what we can do is fight like hell to prevent another lynching in the state of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. His name is Julius Jones, and you can go to justiceforjulius.com. Justiceforjulius.com. We're doing a nationwide push to save this young man's life who's been on death row for almost 20 years. And, you know, people are going to be, you're going to see his name. You're going to see videos. You're going to see influencers. We're going to be talking about him over the next 4 weeks, but we need for I don't care what the show is about, what the topic is about, but if we can always end by saying Justice for Julius or justiceforjulius.com to bring awareness and let's get this partner in parole board to save this man's life. The evidence is just, it's there. There's no reason why. And we know the error rates when it comes to black people in this country who are on death row. And so we don't need another lynching. We don't need another killing in the state of Oklahoma. And so that's my time again. I'm just grateful. Thank you for having us, Christy. Thank you for jumping on. Senator Johnson, we got your back in Oklahoma. And to the rest of the team, Dr. Tatum, thank you for cultivating this relationship. Mr. Tyner and Dr. Cannon and the illustrious Dr. Lee, thank you so much.
Beautiful, real
thank
quick,
you
Dr.
so
Lee.
Much. We appreciate you.
This
yeah, go ahead. Cannon. Go ahead.
If Dr. Tatum could reach out to you and you can get me all the pertinent information that you have, I'd like to put that across my son's desk immediately. So he does several shows. He does Cannon class as well. I think any celebrity, as much celebrity support we can get with Brother Julius Jones, I think that'll be powerful. I know he's already aware. We've already been made aware, but I think anything that you can get me, you know, in bullet points to help push the initiative for that, and so that, like you said, on every show that we're doing, we'll definitely try to mention everything that y'all working with that. You know, I think Black Lives Matter, you're right. We got to make sure a lot of these brothers that's been incarcerated, you know, unfairly, unjustly. The 13th Amendment says that slavery is not allowed in this country except you've been duly convicted of a crime. So they just changed the definition. And so if any of that information you get to me or Dr. Caton, that'd be outstanding.
Thank
I'll,
you so
I'll
much.
Get it
and we will.
Thing tomorrow. I'll get it. We have a toolkit, so if we can get it over to Mr. Cannon, that would be wonderful. We got Rock Nation on board, Daisy. So I'll get that over to you first thing in the morning.
Beautiful.
That's great. And we will definitely keep it in our media as well. That's remember, that's justiceforjulius.com. It's F-O-R spelled out. It's J-U-S-T-I-C-E, F-O-R-J-U-L-I-U-S.com. Thank you so much. We appreciate you. We appreciate all of you. And can't tell you how much we are supportive, and but we will definitely show you. Thank you so very much. So, Michael.
You know, once again, it's been another educational show. I want to thank our guests for joining us tonight and being willing to come on and share their experience and activities with us as they pertain to, you know, racial justice, criminal justice, and the like, and also for making themselves accessible to our listening audience so our audience could partake in the conversation as well and ask them questions. I also want to thank the other fellow co-host and Dr. Mary Lee for putting this show together and enabling us to have conversations of a substantive and educational nature such as this one. And I look forward to and you know, hope for more conversations like this in the future.
Thank you, team. I appreciate you. I love you. To our listening audience, without you, there's no Dr. Mary Lee. Thank you to all of our special guests tonight. Until next week, Dr. Mary Lee says, stay safe. God bless you. Love you. Good night.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement.
Came from the bottom, ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob us, slang, now we locked up again. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states, working your forms. Black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars, but you'll never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong, you act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? You never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up.
Case scenario, might work, still a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the rodent's still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, racing dough. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland Security, now there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Troops still riding, still obliging, still no Bin Laden. Tuned in waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres, take these 40 ounces. We ain't gon' get on the levees. Revolution televised early. Is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Forced to climb instead of how your back heavy, beat and lost your mind. Especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got pawn shop, gun shop, liquor store sign. SWAT team, crack fiend, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You can't ball, then you forced to grind. If you fall, then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. Since phone calls cost a dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent. Brothers not only dealing with the same drugs selling. If I'm a hustler, then what's more American? We all founded on the same drug
America,
heritage.
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Thank God for those who came before, we shall never forget them at all.